Welcome to Pet Food Advisors. I'm Tracy Hotchner, here with my co-host, Dr. Sean Delaney, a board-certified veterinary nutritionist whose company, Balance It, is sought after by pet owners and veterinarians across the world for advice about personalized, optimal nutrition. This show offers well-researched, objective information about pet nutrition, from home cooking to the pet food industry, so you can make thoughtful decisions about feeding your own dogs and cats. This show is a production of Eight Paws LLC and DVM Consulting, Inc., which are solely responsible for its content. The Radio Pet Lady Network is brought to you in part by Spot Platinum, an allergy test to find out what in your dog's environment or diet may be causing his scratching or licking. Allergies for which Spot Platinum can make a USDA-approved serum, custom-tailored to your dog's specific needs to control his symptoms. Spot Platinum is a privately owned company that has done more than 500,000 allergy tests over 25 years. For more information, visit them on the web at www.vetallergy.com. This show is also brought to you by Meow Space, a clear ventilated enclosure that can be a one-cat feeding space, a litter box station, or even a safe place to nap, designed so that only one cat with a unique access device can enter the see-through box. Meow Space is made in the USA to solve out-of-litter box problems and individualized feeding needs in multi-cat households. Big enough for large cats to do their business or small dogs to eat their food in peace, Meow Space benefits the whole family because it keeps dogs and small children out of the litter box, too. Go to meowspace.biz. That's meowspace.biz to see for yourself. Dr. Sean, I am delighted to be with you because if ever there was a man whose name of his company, Balance It, was right up my alley with this question, it would be you. But it may bring a topic to you that isn't one that you fully embrace, which is the idea of raw feeding. But I have had a couple of emails from cat owners who are very devoted and dedicated to feeding their cats raw food. They've had mishaps with some commercially made private companies, raw food, and they want to do it themselves. I know Dr. Elizabeth Hodgkins, who's my co-host on Cat Chat, when she was breeding her Ossa cats and now doesn't breed anymore but has some pet cats, including one she got from the shelter recently, she does make her own food with a commercial grade grinder, and she knows all the other things you have to add to it. So talk to us a little bit specifically about cats who seem to, many of them do extremely well on raw food. This one person who wrote me, her cats now have diarrhea because she went to a company that only sells the meat, not balanced, and she's trying to figure out what to add to it and having digestive upset for either the fact of the origin of the raw meat in the first place or her supplementation. So I know that raw is not your absolute favorite, but we have to accept that there are many people who really want to do it.
Yeah, and I think there's two aspects. I'm perfectly fine with the idea of feeding raw food from the perspective of it on a nutritional basis if done appropriately. What I'm not comfortable with is the still existing risk of zoonotic disease, meaning disease spread from animal to human, and the risk it has for especially children and for the elderly and the immunocompromised. And there's a reason we developed fire as humans and why it provided a benefit to us and why we cook our food. It kills pathogens that would be present otherwise. But having said that, as many people like to point out, dogs and cats evolved on uncooked or raw food. And so why can't we go ahead and feed them that way? And certainly there are a lot of potential benefits. And so I think let's start with why people like raw food and maybe help us understand.
That's a good one, yes.
You know, where they're coming from and then
yes.
how do we make it appropriate, at least nutritionally, and then we can talk a little bit about how you could address the pathogen concern. So people like raw food in large part because it is how we believe that animals have been fed. And, you know, if you've had millions of years of evolution, let's not think we're smarter than evolution and create a new way of feeding animals. And so feeding it makes just teleological is another word for
I
it.
I like that. Word,
sense. And so we would go ahead and we say, okay, let's feed a mouse, you know, and
yes.
And what's great about a mouse? Well, for a cat, we have to recognize that they're an obligate carnivore, which means they have no need and do not need to take in any carbohydrate whatsoever. They eat mostly protein and fat. Now, it's not really true, because if you look at a mouse and you analyze it, there is a little bit of carbohydrate in a mouse, and it's not just the blood sugar that's circulating. There's, you know, as we all, people who do performance athletics and endurance athletics, they know about glycogen and storage of glucose and its utilization. So there's always a little bit of glycogen in a body. And but if you look at a mouse, you know, they're going to have mostly just protein and fat, and probably a little bit more fat than protein. It depends probably on whether you're looking at a field mouse or a mouse that's been raised on, you know, a more controlled environment, may have a little bit of fattier diet and maybe not as much exercise. But regardless, it's mostly protein and fat. And cats choose that as something that makes food very palatable to them. So if you're trying to make a food that's palatable, increasing the protein and the fat content of it makes it much more desirable. And so when you look at a raw food diet, they are typically, but not always, but typically high in protein and high in fat, mirroring that approach that you would look at, let's say, a mouse, since we're focused on the cat, and it makes it very palatable. Well, that's a very important thing to look at as a key performance indicator. If you are the feeder, you want your animal to enjoy what they're eating. You want them to readily eat it. And cats certainly can be finicky about what they like. And so that makes raw food certainly very attractive, because first and foremost, they're going to enjoy it and feel that it's something that they like. It also is something that at times provides more control over what's being fed and more transparency. So yes, there are folks that will grind up raw food and you really can't identify it. But if you're making it yourself, like, you know, you indicated with people taking commercial meat grinders, you actually can see what the material looks like. It's not just a homogeneous brown, you know, dry kibble or, you know, a big pate of retorted or canned food. You can see the actual ingredients going into that. So that's very attractive. And especially amongst people who are concerned about the origin of their food or concerned about how it's been handled, it's certainly is a very nice thing. And they also have to look at convenience. If you look at home cooking, which obviously I spend a lot of time thinking about, the word cook in there, it implies for most people that you actually are heating it. And that adds another step of the process and makes it a little bit less convenient. Whereas if you're feeding raw food, there is no cooking component in the sense of you're combining ingredients, maybe you're having to go gather them, you might be grinding even, but you're not having that added step of having to actually cook it and heat it up and the time that that takes. And so it makes it more convenient and more rapid. And in many cases, for folks that, you know, feed, let's say, a frozen raw food, it's as convenient as dry food in the sense that you open up a package, you pour it into a bowl and you feed it, and there's no more fuss than that. So that's a very attractive aspect of it too. And then let's think about feeding a high protein and high fat diet to a pet. You know, it has a great effect on their coat. You know, high protein, high fat gives them a lustrous coat. It provides all these essential fatty acids, which really just gives a wonderful sheen to the coat. All the protein and amino acids really enables them to make wonderful hair. And so it's
and not get fat themselves.
Not necessarily. Exactly. And so it's a nice, you know, performance. It performs well. And then the other component of performing besides palatability and how does the coat look that people look at is the third aspect, which is, you know, what does it look like at the end of the day when they have to defecate? Well, stool quality is usually very good. It's usually smaller in volume than if there's obviously a lot of fiber in it and it's increasing the volume of the food. And so it doesn't feel like you're wasting your money, if you will, because you're basically cleaning up a lot of yard droppings.
So in the litter box.
Or the litter box. Yes, exactly. Since we're talking about cats. And so it's important to recognize why all these things make it very attractive. And certainly you can mimic that with dry food, with canned food, maybe not the transparency, but high palatability. There are high protein and high fat diets that are low in carbohydrate. They'll have the coat and the stool quality impacts and the palatability, but you don't get the transparency that people would like. And so people are still drawn to it. It's still very much of interest. And so we have to then think about, okay, well, what from a nutritional perspective makes one worried about it? Well, when you look at a lot of recipes, sometimes they're just too simplistic. And we have to remember that for most part, people buy and purchase food that has been highly processed already at the butcher, and it's not representative of what, you know, a whole prey would look like. It's been eviscerated, it's been exsanguinated, and it's been deboned. So the eviscerated means all the internal organs have been removed, and that's removing a lot of minerals and a lot of vitamins in doing so. And then there's also the sanguination, which is just a fancy word of saying we, you know, remove
leave them
the blood.
Out. Yes.
We drain them. Yeah, we drain them of their blood, and a lot of electrolytes are lost in doing that, and a lot of macro minerals that would otherwise be present. That's why when you taste your own blood, it's, you know, bite yourself, you can taste it's salty. There's a lot of electrolytes in there, so we lose that. And then obviously there's more minerals that are lost, calcium and phosphorus most notably, when you debone. And so you have to then replace that if you're going to feed flesh or muscle meat in some way. And that can be done by putting the organ meats back in.
Right.
That can be done with supplementation with vitamins or in some trace minerals. That can be done by putting bone in it. And so recipes that are made that are complete and balanced, that are raw, really do need to have a variety of internal organs. They have to have a variety of bones. And when I've done whole food recipes, even if they're going to be cooked, and I've done this for kind of pro bono work in developing parts of the world in India and Africa, one of the challenges I have found in the past is everything but a few of the trace minerals you can do if you use enough organ meat, but the proportion of organ meat is very, very high. I mean, you have to feed a lot of it. And one of the concerns, certainly in a cat, is that years ago when people, and this is decades ago, when people used to feed a lot more, you know, human foods, one of the clinical presentations you'd see would be hypervitaminosis A, which is just a fancy way of saying high levels of vitamin A. And so there's this balancing act that, yes, you can get a lot of the nutrients you need from organ meats like liver. And when I say organ meats, I'm really talking about liver, because things in kidney a little bit, but, you know, things like heart, yes, that's an organ meat, but it's really mostly muscle, so it doesn't really give you any more benefit.
Oh, interesting.
Then it's a different type of muscle a little
right.
bit, but it's still muscle, and therefore it doesn't have all those as many of those vitamins and minerals like the liver does. And so we're really talking about liver, and so that's an important point, because you'll see sometimes people have this kind of amalgamation of organ meats that they add in, and it may be kidney, it may be lung, and it may be you know, hearts. But if that's diminishing the liver component, that's even more concerning, because you're really looking at the liver. And it's surprising at times how much as a proportion of liver you have to give to meet those needs. Now, some of that's reduced if you're not cooking the liver, because as you cook the liver, you're degrading the heat, degrading the vitamins it contains. But it still can be a little bit of a challenge. And so I think that if someone wants to feed a raw food diet, it's very important that they have that recipe reviewed and looked at to make sure that they're not having proportions of the different ingredients they're using be too low, which is very common, and then create deficiencies. And there's been a few reviews, scientific reviews, where people have, you know, analyzed available recipes online, or that people have been, you know, sharing amongst themselves,
right.
And they have identified that there are commonly issues, and it's often around, you know, calcium and some of the vitamins and minerals that we commonly worry about. Certainly not typically protein or amino acids or fat or fatty acid. That's not where the deficiencies come. And it's the minerals and the vitamins that they don't put back in. And interestingly enough, you can even run into a difficulty when you think you're doing everything right. And I don't know if we've talked about it before, but I actually shared an office when I was a resident. Oh, now we're not dating myself too much, but a decade and a half ago, when I was at UC Davis. And the resident there, the office mate I had, it was a graduate student, and she had done a research project where she was feeding raw ground rabbits to cats. And they were trying to model that if you fed that approach, that you'd have a lower likelihood of developing food allergy. It was an interesting study. I don't think they had enough animals to prove it. But what they did show wasn't that there was any difference whether you cooked it or not. But they did show is that if you feed raw rabbit to cats, over time, they actually can develop taurine deficiency.
How ironic, because I was always told that a mouse was the perfectly balanced natural food for a cat, and that rabbit was like a close second.
And that's what everyone thought. I mean, these are pretty smart people. And her graduate mentor is Niels Petersen, who's one of the, I would say, grandfathers of feline medicine.
Yes.
And has done research for years. And, you know, one of the guys that, you know, identified a lot of the cat diseases. I mean, so it's not like a, you know, someone just coming off the street.
Right.
And you know, Davis, my mentors when I was at Davis, both Jim Morris and Quentin Rogers literally wrote the book about the nutrient requirements of cats. So it's not coming out of a place from ignorance.
Right.
And what was interesting was they found is that just the concentration of taurine in rabbits is not as great as it is in small rodents like a mouse. And so there was a way to create a deficiency. Now, there is also some aspects of, was there a fiber effect, which you can see without getting into too many details. Taurine is used to make bile acids, to conjugate them, as we call it. And those bile acids, which help emulsify the fat that you digest, are reabsorbed as an efficient, you know, a use of them. So as they get excreted into the GI tract and then further down the tract, they get reabsorbed and reutilized. Well, if you have a lot of fiber in your diet, the fiber binds some of that bile acids and actually exits through the feces and you lose it and you have an increased need. And cats conjugate bile acids exclusively with taurine. So if you have a lot of fiber in the diet, you can actually increase their taurine requirement. And so some of the debate about, you know, this issue is that the cats were being given the entire pelt of the...
That was what I was going to ask you, whether the mouse's fur and bony structure is an important part of a mouse being the perfect food. So the rabbit were being fed with their fur on.
That's right. And so there's some debate, was there an increased loss through...
Right.
Was enterohepatic, that's the entero is the intestinal tract, hepatic being liver, enterohepatic circulation, was it affected and therefore the taurine recirculation and reuptake was affected? Don't know because they didn't do follow-up work. Obviously proved that grinding up whole rabbits, not only is it really a very, I'm sure, challenging and not very pleasant work, it's not the way to feed a cat. And you can develop a unique deficiency, which you wouldn't anticipate. And so care has to be definitely taken when combining all these and trying to, in essence, rebuild out of other components a mouse. And that's what you're really doing, right?
Yes.
And you're trying to make a mouse and recombine it in a way. And not just a mouse in the way that a cat might consume it. And that's important to remember. You know, the mouse may not eat every component of
In fact, they don't, right? I mean, there are people who are kind of naysayers, if you will, to raw feeding or to the concept that cats are absolutely obligate carnivores with no need for carbs. And I've heard people say, oh, yeah, but they eat all of that carbohydrate material in the digestive tract of the mouse. But is it not true that a cat left to her own devices, a barn cat, leaves the guts out of the picture? Right? I mean, yeah, isn't the head not, the first thing they eat?
It's not always. I don't think it's always that way. But yes, I think that you have to remember both dogs and cats will take in the things that we would just talked about. They will eat the liver and they'll drink the blood and they'll look for some of the flesh. They often will avoid some of the lower intestinal tract, which kind of makes sense because there's all these nasty bugs and bacteria that you have to deal with. That probably is not a good strategy. Although we love to talk about probiotics, that may be a little bit overdoing it and how much they have to deal with.
Well, I know that it seems like I'm stopping you from continuing with the train of thought, but the head and the brain, all the cats I've ever had that were outdoor cats when I had a house where they were mostly outdoors by their own choice. That's where they chose to spend like 90% of their time. I think a lot of people have found, decapitated rodent brought to them. Like the cat maybe didn't like the rest of it or was not so hungry, but they eat the head first. So is there something in the brain matter? I mean, that's not muscle. Maybe the brain matter is full of something of great value. Is that possible?
Well, I don't know that. I will say that it's a very fatty component. I mean, one of the things you have to remember about the way that neurons work is that they're kind of like copper wires. There's actual coating, if you will, insulation around the outside of it, and that's a very fatty component. So fat is very palatable and very desirable. So if I was a guessing person, which is what I'm basically doing,
right,
it may be the higher fat content that makes it very delectable. It also probably is a way of killing. You have to remember that's...
Oh, right, yes.
Yeah, an often way is, you know, decapitation is 100% effective in killing most animals.
It works, yes. And on the other hand, they may decapitate and leave the head behind, and we just never knew. They just bring you back the corpse.
That's also the other aspect of that. You're just seeing the corpse being brought to you.
Right, as a lovely offering, and you go, that's okay, but no, thank you. If they were doing this interesting study, why didn't they use mice? I mean, why look for a mouse substitute when mice are plentifully available?
They're not as plentiful as you would think, and I think it was a cost a component. I remember talking to Angie about this, and now I'm going to forget her last name and not appropriately refer to her as Dr. So-and-so, but
Dr. Anyway. Angie, we'll call her.
and I think it was a cost that they could get more for a cost, a cost per pound, if you will, basis.
Yes.
Was more effective because you're most likely getting a supply from a lab animal, and it's not that they're selling it for meat normally. They're selling it, and so a cost per animal may be a little bit higher for a mouse than it is for a rabbit. And so it was just, I think, a more cost-effective, they thought, way of feeding and preparing it. So that's why I think that the rabbit was used versus, you know, using a whole bunch of mice. But
right.
Yes, I think you would anticipate that had they done the study in mice, they would not have seen taurine deficiency. And they went back, and the evidence supports at least that mice are more rich in taurine, and it makes a lot of sense. So anyway, the point really being is that even with the best of intentions and knowledge, you can have things go awry, and unless you test it or look at the actual nutrient profile what you're feeding, you can have deficiencies, and those deficiencies can go from, you know, potentially very minor consequences to very severe, with obviously taurine deficiency, if left unchecked, being fatal, leading to heart failure. And so it's important, I think, for folks to recognize that if they want to feed a homemade or a raw food diet specifically, unrelated to the last component of the zoonotic disease potential or even the disease potential in general, they need to make sure that all the different components, just like any diet, are accounted for, and the minerals and vitamins being the ones of most concern.
Okay, so let's talk about that. The person buys, I know there was someone that once called into Cat Chat and said, oh, I got the most romantic anniversary present from my husband. He gave me a commercial meat grinder, and she laughed, but they're expensive apparently, because you could put an entire chicken, bones and all, feet, bones, what have you, into this grinder, and out it comes as a ground stuff into your bowl. If somebody were to take a whole chicken, and I guess you would have to take the eviscerated, exsanguinated one that's in the supermarket. Maybe someone with a food co-op could get one that's a little less kind of cleaned up. But if you were to take that entire chicken, bones and all, one assumes in America, usually not with the head and the feet, although in Europe, you see the head and the feet come with as well. What would they need to add to make that a well-balanced diet for a cat?
Well, two comments on that. One is that you have to recognize that sometimes there's some database holes that we have, because in general, we rely heavily on the USDA database, which the USDA database is developed for humans for making comparisons to what they're being fed. And therefore, it's analysis of food that you in the way that people feed it. And so if you look up chicken, it'll often say refuse bone. It means that they have not analyzed the mineral content with the bone involved. And so we do have some data. Often it comes from zoos where they feed this strategy and they've had to analyze. But one would anticipate, and I don't know, for example, the whole chicken, what its calcium to phosphorus amount would be. And you have to remember that, you know, the amount of breast meat that now comes with chicken and even how fatty it is in some of these layers or fryers is very
strange
proportion. And so you might be under, even though there is calcium and phosphorus that is going to be coming in, it may not be enough to meet the requirement. I just have never done that. The work has come up frequently and we've had discussions about it. But what I would definitely anticipate is, as you point out, is the exsanguination. And you would anticipate that magnesium, potassium, sodium, chloride, the other macro minerals besides calcium and phosphorus might be too low and would need to be fortified. Now, how does that usually happen? And assuming you're not going to be pouring chicken blood back in like a voodoo ceremony.
Hard to get your hands on some chicken blood
right,
in this day and age.
Be. Yeah, it can be. Sometimes you can find it in ethnic stores, actually. They do
no
sell it.
No kidding.
Yeah. You know, I do know because of family relationships that Filipinos still cook with blood, and so you can buy blood.
And of course, there's blood sausage that is made in Europe.
Right, and so there are ways of buying blood, but for the most part, it's a little bit trickier. And so most people are going to be using salt to achieve that, and or buying like Epsom salt, magnesium sulfate, for example, to provide the magnesium. And light salt is often how one refers to a combination of potassium chloride and sodium chloride, so that you can get your potassium, your sodium, and your chloride. And so that would be one aspect of what you would anticipate you're going to have to add back in because of the loss of the blood. The other component is whether the amount of liver internal organs that are provided are going to provide enough vitamins. And that would be, you know, combination of analysis and to look at that as well as maybe making the chicken a little bit richer in liver, if you will, than it would otherwise be, to try to mirror more what the mouse looks like. And so in any event, you end up with those components, if you will, brought all back together. And if you get the right combination, you would hope and anticipate that you've now met their requirement. And then the worry becomes food safety. So unfortunately, in the human food side of things, we do not have safe food from a microbiology perspective. And you can look at the estimates and they track this. But, you know, chicken has a tolerable level. You can have a high percentage of your chicken coming out with salmonella on it, and it's acceptable as a food processing plant for humans because the expectation is it's going to be cooked. And it can go as high as 70% at times of chicken being contaminated. Now, if you exceed a certain number, and I can't remember if it's 25%, but there was a recent recall here in California for a major poultry supplier because they exceeded whatever the normal limit would be of how much of it could have contamination, if you will. But it's still, I mean, it's not that it's coming out that it's zero, which is what you have expectation of complete and balanced commercially prepared pet food. And if there's any salmonella found in it, it's recalled, right? We keep on hearing about recall.
That's
salmonella,
right.
Salmonella. That's any, if it finds any. Whereas with chicken that's raw, it's a certain threshold that you're allowed, and then over that you have to then recall or have problems. And so you have to assume that you're always dealing with contaminated meat. And it's similar with beef, with E. coli.
Right.
And now Listeria has become more of a concern for folks as well, which you need to think about with cold cuts and stuff. But Listeria has been
and
soft cheeses especially, that Listeria has been a concern. What usually people, you know, have been concerned about it because of pregnant women, they're aware of that, and but Listeria seems to becoming more frequently raised as a concern as well. And so anyway, there are definitely, you just have to make the assumption that whatever you buy, no matter how lovely, high quality, organic, et cetera, that there is going to be contamination on it. And so you have to then decide how you're going to handle that. Now, some people say, well, my dog and cat's never had a problem. And that may be true. Whether they are more resistant or have been lucky or just haven't shown clinical signs, it's always unclear. There are certainly reported cases where they've traced it and proven that, you know, just like humans, that there have been dogs and cats that have gotten food poisoning and they've gotten sick from the food that they've eaten. And some people say, I don't recognize that. Well, what do you think? I think I always say, when you hear about garbage gut, which is animals that got into garbage and they ate and then they got sick. Well, was it really because they got into something fatty, or is it because they got something that went bad and it had something growing on it and it just exceeded their capacity to tolerate, you know? And they're not vultures. They don't have the ability to eat things that have gone off completely.
Right.
So it's important to remember that. And so when we realize that there's that risk, you have to decide, okay, how am I going to deal with it? I'm putting an animal at risk, maybe, maybe not. But then the zoonotic disease has really become a big concern, and it's why there's a lot of caution around it, because the liability when you start going into the human world arena, and I think we've talked about this in the past, but now, you know, there's cases, for example, of a small child getting it sick and getting salmonella and not only almost dying and being in NICU at a very young age, and tracing the DNA back, in this case, to commercial food that wasn't properly heat processed. So it wasn't raw food, but it was still the same pathogens we worry about. And now also later in life is now still at a young age, 2 or 3, passing salmonella in her feces, even though she's well, she's a carrier and can't be in a communal setting.
Wow.
And now can't have, you know, child care, which most people rely on. And one of the parents has to stay home, and the monetary losses that are associated with that, and who's responsible. Is it the retailer? Is the manufacturer? Is it both of them? And one of the questions that's raised amongst veterinarians is, if I'm a veterinarian and I said, sure, feed raw, and this happens, am I, as a medical professional who has specifically in my veterinary oath an obligation to public health and prevention of zoonotic disease, am I also liable, being aware that there is a risk for transmission of these pathogens, which you know are going to be in the food, into the environment? And people say, oh, well, I keep a clean kitchen and I, you know, really clean it, and absolutely may do that and have no issues with that. But we have to remember that dogs and cats don't wash their paws after they
right.
use the litter, and they love to lick their private areas. And
yep.
so there's fecal oral contamination, and then they walk on the counters, they lick you, they touch you, they paw you. And that's a wonderful thing, having an animal in your house, but they're not an animal in a bubble. They
right.
certainly are an animal that
far from hygienic. I know that the AVMA has made a statement against raw feeding, because any large organization always has to err on the side of caution, and because we are such a litigious society, that rather than understanding that things just happen, the universe is not in our control, you know, bad things happen to good people with the best of intentions, people just want to sue everybody up the yin yang. And of course, those who espouse more quote unquote natural or unprocessed feeding, i.e. raw feeding of animals, would say quite rightly that the contamination that has been found in the pet food world has all been highly processed foods. And the contamination happened somewhere along the line or after the line. So it's important for you to point it out, but I just want to be the voice saying yes. And those on the side that embrace raw feeding for the reasons that you said, the least processed, the most natural form, not that the dogs and cats who live in our lives now, I would say, are not a natural creation. We have created them. We have manipulated them with breeding so that they often don't very much resemble their more ancient or wilder ancestors or cousins. But I think that the caution makes a lot of sense, but it really isn't a reason against it. I guess that really what I'm saying is for people that say, I understand. I want to feed raw. How do I balance it? What formulas can we give them? I mean, your company exists to help people that want to step outside of the normal path of pet feeding and make their own version of it. It may not be that raw would be your number one choice for them. But if it's their number one choice for themselves, what do we tell them to do? If somebody called up a vet or a pet owner and said, doctor, I want to do raw. Now, the thing that's weird to me about this liver component is two things. One is, it would seem to me that the proportion of liver to body flesh and bony structure and fur on a mouse is really not very high. I mean, percentage-wise, I can't imagine it's like even 10% of his overall weight. And yet you're saying that if you're to use commercial chicken, you have to go to a very high or much higher percentage of liver, chicken liver, obviously not mouse liver because it's not available, in order to make it really nicely balanced. Why is that? Because liver is something that, although it has many wonderful qualities and used to be fed regularly to human children every week, whether they liked it or not, it's also the filter for all the toxins. So I would, of any creature. So I'm wondering, you know, if you need a lot of it in order to make the food properly balanced, are you inserting or creating another potential problem because you have a kind of a toxic organ that you're feeding a lot of?
So two points. I'm suggesting that I don't know for sure, but I would anticipate that you would have to give more liver than you might think otherwise, or that would naturally come. And part of that is related to our breeding of chickens, that they're no longer a normal
right.
ratio of
right.
meat and fat to liver.
Right.
Whereas a mouse, we haven't bred to be producing this gigantic breast
right.
that we can enjoy of lots of meat and lots of fat. And so that was really my point. So their normal ratio
right.
is maybe thrown off. And then I throw in that the rabbit, which I would say evolutionarily is more similar to a mouse than a mouse is to a chicken, also have to be thrown into consideration that, yes, it was taurine, but species across species doesn't mean that the nutrient concentration is the same. And so you'd have to be careful. And then the other component that you have to remember is that many people are going to also want to account for vitamin degradation with time. So vitamins start degrading right away. So that may be a concern with storage and things. I mean, you're not eating food literally as it just died.
Right.
So there is a component. And then there's a safety margin that people will want because of individual variation. You might have liver where you'll get data that it says, okay, the amount of thiamine is X, but it can vary by plus or minus 30%. And so you're then wanting to correct for that plus or minus 30% so that you ensure that at no time do you then have a deficiency for fear of what the consequence of that be. So those are all kind of the considerations why may shift it more than you would expect, if you will.
Well, if taurine Chlorine is something that's always added by necessity to canned cat food. It's like you could just, if you wanted, just have chicken in a can, but you have to add taurine. Do you at Balance It make a taurine? Do you have available taurine so that somebody that wants to grind the chicken in their commercial grinder, you know, bones and all, but minus these other things, can you provide them with taurine?
The closest we've gotten is our carnivore blend, which we designed. Frankly, it's become our third best-selling product, and I resisted making it for many years.
Because I didn't even know about it.
I'm more of a veteran nutritionist who thinks I know more than I probably do, than I'm a better business person. And so I was very resistant for a long time, and we developed the carnivore blend, which is for an all meat or all poultry or all fish diet. Now, it's designed where the way most people feed is that most people aren't grinding up bones or including bones anymore. So it has calcium and phosphorus in it to correct for that loss. But it is designed where you just mix it with, you know, your piece of meat, your ground
meat,
filet, and then it makes it complete and balanced. And it's designed to be cooked. We have people that want to not cook it, but it's designed to be cooked, which means it has extra vitamins so that it corrects for the heat degradation. And it's a very fast and easy way. I often utilize it, and people utilize it, and veterinarians utilize it for those dogs that have trained their owners that they only want to eat chicken, and then for finicky cats,
yes,
you know, and that they won't eat anything else. So that's the solution we've come up with. From our perspective, from a liability perspective as a small company, we can't afford even a single lawsuit with someone saying, I got sick, human-wise. And so we've just avoided the whole concept and say, yep, you need to cook it. But from all the other components, that was our solution. And it's been interesting to see how quickly it's been embraced and utilized, because I think people do like to feed a very high-protein, high-meat diet. They do like to feed a low-carb diet. They do like to feed a single-antigen diet that's used frequently for that reason, where they don't want to feed any carbohydrates, or they want to limit how many things they're feeding, and they want to have as simple of a recipe as they possibly can.
So I could go to a BJ's or a Costco and buy an enormous amount of skinless, boneless, because it's just easier to deal with, chicken leg or chicken breast, and cook it up, because I would choose to cook it in my case, grind it and cook it and grind it, whichever. And how would I know how much carnivore blend to add if I was giving it raw to a cat or cooked to a dog? Would it be based on the proportion of carnivore blend to the amount of protein, or would it be based on the size of the animal or the species of the animal?
It's species and what's being fed. So any supplement, ours included, you always have to know what's being fed to figure out the dose. And I think we've in years past touched upon this, but my best example of this is that when you make a diet that's, let's say, and we're going to use the dog because it's the most extreme example, where you're feeding them a vegetarian diet and you're giving them tofu, let's say, and rice, there is no vitamin D in that diet. Whereas you feed them a salmon diet that's mostly salmon or just salmon, you're already getting to the close to the safe upper limit for vitamin D, just from the salmon source. And so if you don't know what's being fed, you have the risk of under supplementing or over supplementing. And so we here, for figuring that out, provide a free tool at balance.it, where all they do is they click, I want to feed chicken thigh or chicken breast, or brown chicken, and then click done. And it gives them the amount of the carnivore blend to use in their particular dog or cat.
Okay, so we've run out of time, but just to be clear, while you cannot say for legal reasons, go ahead and feed that protein raw, if a person were by their own choice, not your recommendation, wanting to feed that protein raw, would they need to recalculate the amount of Balance It? Because you said it's been formulated so that it can withstand heat and therefore some loss. Would they be overdoing it if they use that proportion and
very
wanted
quickly,
to serve it raw?
Very quickly, and this is not me recommending doing this, but the only concern would be if they were feeding a marine fish-rich diet to a dog, because that vitamin D degradation wouldn't have been accounted for, and then you could overdo it. In a cat, in any circumstance, there wouldn't be a concern. The extra vitamins would just be, you know,
excreted.
Excreted or just stored, and they, because the fat solubles aren't really excreted.
Okay, so here's what I have to say to our cat-loving raw feeders. We have your answer. It's called carnivore blend because you have an obligate carnivore.
But you should cook it because I don't want
to
have
any. You should cook it because Dr. Sean doesn't want to know about any salmonellas crawling around on your counter or your floor. But,
and one last thing before we go is high-pressure processing. Commercially available raw foods are available that are supposed to be and should be food safe, where they undergo many atmospheres of pressure to destroy pathogens. And you can purchase those from a variety of manufacturers. manufacturers now that are still considered raw, but no longer have pathogens and should be food safe.
Okay, so one last question. I want to make it myself. My husband gives me the grinder. I want to take advantage of it. If I were to freeze it in my very, very good freezer, would that do anything before I then defrosted it to feed it?
Freezing can reduce burden, but it's been shown multiple times not to kill everything. So things will survive both parasites and bacteria through the freezing.
Yuck. Okay, good to know. So those of you that are brave and brazen, go right ahead. And the rest of you, a little heat goes a long way. Dr. Sean, thank you so much. We'll be back soon with more on the topic of what goes in your pet's mouth and comes out the other end. Thank you, Dr. Sean.
Bye-bye.
Thanks for listening. The Radio Pet Lady Network is brought to you in part by Spot Platinum, an allergy test for which elements in your dog's environment or diet may be causing his scratching or licking. He may have allergies that Spot Platinum can determine and for which they can make a USDA-approved serum custom-tailored to your dog's specific needs to control his symptoms. Spot Platinum is a privately owned company that has done more than 500,000 allergy tests over 25 years. For more information, visit them on the web at vetallergy.com. Support for the show also comes from VaxiCheck, a simple test done right in your vet's office to discover whether your dog or puppy is protected from the deadly core diseases or needs revaccination. Shelters can use VaxiCheck on new arrivals to separate healthy dogs from unprotected ones and avoid unnecessarily over-vaccinating dogs. VaxiCheck, for your dog's safety and your peace of mind. And VaxiCheck for cats is coming soon.